Welcome to the Veterans for Peace Radio Hour and podcast on Radio Free Nashville, 107.1 and 103.7, and streaming live at radiofreenashville.org. So today, we're going to hear from Caitlin Johnstone on the hypocrisy of the U.S. on press freedom. Then we're going to hear from Sagar and Crystal from Breaking Points on the ignored danger of a drone attack on the Kremlin. Then we're going to listen to Juan Gonzalez on the movement to bury the Monroe Doctrine. And finally, Yiannis Varoufakis on the European countries as vassals to the United States. But first, my name is Jim Wohlgemuth, and I'm here with fellow Vietnam veteran Harvey Bennett. We're members of Veterans for Peace. Veterans for Peace is an international organization of military veterans and allies whose collective efforts are to build a culture of peace, humanity, equality, and justice. Just go to veteransforpeace.org. This radio show and podcast is on stations across the country thanks to Pacifica Radio Network. We're also on SoundCloud, Anchor Podcast, Spotify, your phone podcast app. Just search Veterans for Peace. The Veterans for Peace Radio Hour and Radio Free Nashville are supported in part by you, the listener, because it is you that keeps the Radio Free Nashville going. And as a result, this radio show is then picked up by the Pacifica Radio Network so that we are heard across the country. Can you imagine? So if you think this is important, just go to radiofreenashville.org and click on the donate button and keep Harvey and I on the air in every time zone in the U.S. Oh, and if you have a mind, you can also go to Veterans for Peace and go to the veteransforpeace.org and do the same thing. Okay, while mainstream media, YouTube, Twitter, and other platforms are censoring voices of activism and dissent, we will continue to share those voices who stand up against the establishment, who stand up against the military-industrial congressional media corporate complex, who stand up for us, the global us. So Harvey, we're going to touch on four things today. I know I wanted to quickly mention about Biden administration when it comes to freedom of the press and Julian Assange, but there's no need for us to discuss this when Caitlin Johnstone already addressed it and posted it on SoundCloud. So here is Caitlin Johnstone's article read by Tim Foley.
Wednesday was World Press Freedom Day, and it saw U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre, and Deputy State Department spokesman Vedant Patel confronted about the glaring hypocrisy of the Biden administration's persecution of Julian Assange for the crime of good journalism. During an appearance at a World Press Freedom event hosted by The Washington Post's David Ignatius on Wednesday morning, Blinken was confronted by Code Pink activists Medea Benjamin and Tighe Berry, demanding justice for Assange before swiftly being dragged off stage. "Excuse us, we can't use this day without calling for the freedom of Julian Assange," said Benjamin. The two were immediately rushed by many security staffers, and the audio from the stage was temporarily cut. "Stop the extradition of Julian Assange," Benjamin can be heard saying. 2 hours and not one word about journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, who was murdered by the Israeli occupation forces in Palestine. Not one word about Julian Assange, said Barry. "We're here to celebrate freedom of expression, and we just experienced it," said Ignatius, without a trace of irony once the dissent had been silenced. He then returned to the subject of how bad and awful the Russian government is for imprisoning American journalist Evan Gershkovich. Then, during a White House press briefing on Wednesday afternoon, Karine Jean-Pierre was asked a question by CBS News' Stephen Portnoy that was so inconvenient the press secretary flat out said she would not answer it. Advocates on Twitter today have been talking a great deal about how the United States has engaged in hypocrisy by talking about how Evan Gershkovich is being held in Russia on espionage charges, but the United States has Espionage Act charges pending against Julian Assange. "Can you respond to that criticism?" asked Portnoy. "What is the criticism?" asked Jean-Pierre. "Well, the criticism is that the argument is that Julian Assange is a journalist who engaged in the publication of government documents," Portnoy replied. "The United States is accusing him of a crime under the Espionage Act, and that, therefore, the United States is losing the moral high ground when it comes to the question of whether a reporter engages in espionage as a function of his work. So can you respond to that?" "Look, I'm not going to speak to Julian Assange in that case from here," said Jean-Pierre. And then she didn't. She just dismissed Portnoy's question without explanation. then babbled for a while about things Biden has said that are supportive of press freedoms, and then again repeated, I'm not going to weigh in on comments about Julian Assange. This type of I'm not answering that screw you dodge is a rare move for a White House press secretary. They don't normally just come right out and say they refuse to answer the highly relevant and easily answerable question a reporter just asked. Typically, when the question is too inconvenient, they'll either word salad a bewildering non-response, say the answer is the jurisdiction of another department, or say they'll get back to them when they have more information. But really, what choice did she have? As Wall Street Journal White House correspondent Sabrina Siddiqui recently acknowledged on MSNBC, the job of the White House press secretary is not to tell the truth, but to stay on message and control the narrative. There is nothing about the Assange case that is on message with the White House narrative. Just the other day, Biden said at the White House Correspondents' Dinner that journalism is not a crime, yet his persecution of Assange is deliberately designed to criminalize journalism. There's simply no way to reconcile the U.S. government's story about itself with its efforts to normalize the extradition and persecution of journalists around the world under the Espionage Act. If your job is to make the White House look good, the only way to respond to questions of U.S. hypocrisy regarding the Assange case is not to respond at all. Later in the press conference, Jean-Pierre responded to another reporter's questions about press freedoms in China with an assurance that the Biden administration will, quote, hold accountable the autocrats and their enablers who continue to repress a free, independent media. Also on Wednesday afternoon, AP's Matt Lee cited the aforementioned Code Pink protest earlier that day to question Deputy State Department spokesman Vedant Patel about Assange, and was met with a similar amount of evasiveness. So then, can I ask you, as was raised perhaps a bit abruptly at the very beginning of his comments this morning, whether or not the State Department regards Julian Assange as a journalist who would be covered by the ideas embodied in the World Press Freedom Day? Asked Lee. The State Department thinks that Mr. Assange has been charged with serious criminal conduct in the United States in connection with his alleged role in one of the largest compromises of classified information in our nation's history, Patel replied. His actions risked serious harm to U.S. national security, to the benefit of our adversaries. It put named human sources to grave and imminent risk, and risk of serious physical harm and arbitrary detention. So it does not matter how we categorize any person. But this is, we view this as something that's been charged with serious criminal conduct. Well, but it does matter, actually, and that's my question. Do you believe he is a journalist or not? Asked Lee. Our view on Mr. Assange is that he's been charged with serious criminal conduct in the United States, said Patel. Yeah, but anyone can be charged with anything, Lee replied. Evan Gershkovich has been charged with a serious criminal offense in Russia, and you say that he is a journalist, and he is, obviously. And I just want to know whether or not you, the State Department, regardless of any charges that he faces, believe that he is a journalist, or he is something else. Before again repeating his line that Assange has been charged with a very serious crime. Okay, so basically the bottom line is that you don't have an answer. You won't say whether you think he is a journalist or not, Lee replied. Again, Patel was left with no safe answers to Lee's questions, because of course Assange is indisputably a journalist. Publishing information and reporting that is in the public interest is precisely the thing that journalism is. That's why Assange has won so many awards for journalism. Trying to contend that Assange is not a journalist is an unwinnable argument. Later in that same press conference, Patel was challenged on his claim that Assange damaged U.S. national security by Accuracy.org's Sam Husseini. You refer to WikiLeaks allegedly damaging U.S. national security, said Husseini. People might remember that WikiLeaks came to prominence because they released the collateral murder video. And what that showed was U.S. military mowing down Reuters reporters, workers in Iraq. Reuters repeatedly asked the U.S. government to disclose such information about those killings, and U.S. government repeatedly refused to do so. Only then did we know what happened, that the U.S. helicopter gunship mowed down these Reuters workers through the collateral murder video. Are you saying that disclosure of such criminality by the U.S. government impinges U.S. national security? I'm not going to parse or get into specifics, Patel said, before again repeating his line that Assange stands accused of serious crimes in a way that harmed U.S. national security. Journalist Max Blumenthal tweeted about Patel's remarks, according to this State Department flack, Julian Assange's jailing is justified because he harmed U.S. national security. But Assange is not an American citizen. By this logic, the U.S. can kidnap and indefinitely detain any foreign journalist who offends the U.S. national security state. Highlighting this hypocrisy shows that the U.S. empire does not in fact care about press freedoms at all, save only to the extent that it can pretend to care about them to wag its finger at governments it doesn't like. Assange exposed many things about our rulers during his work with WikiLeaks, but none of those revelations have been as significant as what he's forced them to reveal about themselves and the lengths that they will go to silence a journalist who tells inconvenient truths.
So there was the clip from Caitlin Johnstone, and it's read by Tim Foley. And, you know, I just recommend folks sign up for her her discussions, because she is great. And it's Caitlin with a C and Johnstone.
Her stuff's on SoundCloud. That's usually where we
get her on SoundCloud. Mm-hmm. So,
well, you know, the Times and Washington Post, and I think maybe the Guardian all very belatedly issued these sort of lukewarm statements.
Yeah.
Hey, let's not extradite Assange, because after all, well, they should not want that to happen, because their own reporters would be next, or could be. But then they said nothing about this farce the other day with World on Press Freedom Day.
No.
Were their reporters, and why weren't they challenging anything that was said?
And that's what's shocking to me these days. You would think that a press that wants to have press freedom would be clamoring constantly and putting pressure on the United States and on Britain to drop the charges and free Julian Assange. And I just don't get it. There's the continued hypocrisy from the Biden administration, but it goes back and back and back. Mm-hmm. So we've been consistent in our hypocrisy. Done.
On Press Freedom Day.
Harvey, you also found a clip from Breaking Points with Crystal and Sager.
Yes. Well, they lead with the story of the drone attacks, and they show film, and then they show CNN talking to the CIA, where he says, you know, sounds like a false flag. They don't challenge it. They don't ask any follow-up questions. Okay, that's settled, you know, and doesn't even begin to look at that entire event and the significance of it. It's been very little in the press. I don't watch cable, so I don't know if they've talked in any real serious analysis, but Crystal and Sager take it on, and they really show us just how insane and dangerous this is.
And this clip is called CNN Claims Putin Drone Attack is a False Flag.
So much of the population that they just see Zelensky as a hero and they just dismiss it out of hand. There's no way possible that he could have done this. Think about the incentive that they have here too, which is something that we have always flagged as a real danger. It is in the Ukrainians' interest to have an escalation that would draw us directly into the conflict. So when we look at something like this and we're like, this is insane. You're trying to potentially assassinate the leader of a nuclear-armed superpower? Like, what in the world are you up to? But their calculus is very different. Their interests are not in this way actually aligned with us. They would like to see some sort of escalation that forces our hand and draws us directly into this war, because frankly, that is the only way that they would outright win. So that has always been there, but I just really want to urge people to think about how much fire we are playing with here. Because even if you submit there was like a 1% chance that this was the Ukrainians, these are our partners and allies. They did not warn us probably in advance that they were going to do this. We have no control over them. And we also know from the leaked documents and from a lot of other reporting, we have less insight in some ways into what the Ukrainians are up to, because we don't have these deep intelligence networks that we've been working on for decades with regard to the Ukrainians, and they don't let us in on what they're up to. We have less insight into their operations in some ways than the Russians.
Yeah.
We are playing with fire. This is an insane situation, and it just reminds me again, whatever we can do to get this conflict to an end is incredibly critical.
This is the issue. You know, the NAFO people who are out there are always like, well, the Moscow has tried to assassinate Zelensky. Yeah, who's defending Moscow? Okay?
Right.
If the Ukraine, listen, people dismiss any concern of ours as some sort of condemnation on Ukraine. If Ukraine wants to put itself in a position to risk its annihilation, they are free to do that. But then, should said risk happen, they should bear 100% of the risk and of the possibility without any of the escalation coming back on us. And that's part of why I'm so annoyed by the discourse around this. We are tied at the hip. Not by my choice, I can tell you that, but by the choice, though, of the President of the United States, of NATO, and the entire Western alliance, who seems to have lost their minds. And they seem to think that, you know, we are going to rise and, you know, fall with whatever happens to Ukraine. And if that's the case, then of course, as you said, Ukraine is of their fate and what happens to them is now directly tied to us. And so we should have some say in the matter.
When you're dealing with nukes, what's going on here is tied to everyone on the planet.
Right.
I mean, even if we weren't so directly involved and basically a proxy, you know, fighters alongside of the Ukrainians with, by the way, some limited number of boots on the ground and providing a lot of intelligence to help them with their targeting and all of those things. And of course, the money and the weapons and all that we have sent over there. Even if that wasn't the case, every single person on the planet should be concerned about what's going on here.
Sure. The fact that so many people want to call it a false flag is the tell in and of itself, because they have to, because by doing that, they can push responsibility off the Ukrainians. Because if we all acknowledge that it is, then they have to acknowledge them that they've done something incredibly risky.
I also want you to think about, you know, with Panetta there on with Jake Tapper. Now, if you ever had anyone with a critical view, as we do, or a skeptical view, as we do, go on and say, you know, this really looks like a Ukrainian attack. Oh, they'd be up at arms.
Oh, they'd be freaking
There's no
out.
Way yeah. you could just say that without right. Tapper jumping in and pressing,
yes.
which, you know what? He should, right?
Sure.
But you got to do it on the other side, too. Mm-hmm. And Panetta's just allowed to float this with no backing, no evidence, no nothing, just because he wants it to be true. And no pushback from the media. This becomes the accepted narrative. Let me just say, if you are more inclined than we are to believe Zelensky's denials and believe this was a potential false flag, please acknowledge there is at least a chance that this was the Ukrainians. And if there's even a chance that they are freelancing and engaging in this type of incredibly reckless actions, that should change your whole way that you're thinking about this war.
Yeah, absolutely.
The idea that CNN and Jake Tapper are talking about are calling this whole thing, this drone attack on the Kremlin, as a false flag. I'm trying to think, come on, you've got to put yourself in somebody else's boots. Would the Kremlin actually send a drone over and strike the flagpole above the Capitol or whatever they did? It makes no sense.
I'm just still a little anxious. I think, you know, we haven't seen this play out. We don't know Russia's retaliation yet. It hasn't happened yet. It could be something unprecedented in this war. I think this drone attack, they're going to do something to disincentivize Ukraine from trying that again. And I think it's going to be on Kiev, and I think it's going to be on a scale they haven't come close to experiencing up to
That's
this
right. And then it's going to be our response that we're worried
yeah,
about.
And then everyone's going to say, now we have to give them fighters and blah, blah. Glad Crystal said takeaway is how absolutely critical it is to end this war, because we see where it's going.
So the next thing I wanted to share with folks was just a very short portion of a great webinar hosted by Code Pink on the Monroe Doctrine. It is the 200th anniversary of the Monroe Doctrine. And if you're listening to this, you have heard of the Monroe Doctrine, I'm sure. So why would there be a movement to get rid of the Monroe Doctrine? So I would like to share the opening address by Juan Gonzalez, co-host of Democracy Now! And if you're probably listening to our show, you're a fan of Democracy Now! He gives a great history of the Monroe Doctrine and its impact. I will not do any spoilers, but the impact is far more than what you and I would automatically think of. So here's that.
Calling for an end to the Monroe Doctrine and for a new U.S. policy toward Latin America. There are today 62 million people of Latin American descent in the United States, that says the Census Bureau as of actually of 2020, 18.7% of the population. It's actually 65.2 million. If you include the people of Puerto Rico, U.S. citizens since 1917, which the Census Bureau never does when counting U.S. Hispanics. That is an astounding number when you consider that a little more than 50 years ago, when I was a young radical member of the Young Lords Party, the Latinx population was just 9.1 million and represented a mere 4.5% of the population. So the first thing that we must grasp is that we are living through and witnessing an historic transformation of the very composition of the U.S. population. The main theme of my book, Harvest of Empire, when I wrote it nearly a quarter century ago, is that the mushrooming migration from Latin America, Asia, and Africa to the rich nations of the world can only be understood and ultimately will only be resolved by a reckoning with the legacy of the colonial empires of the U.S. and other Western nations that they created in those regions during the previous two centuries. Quite simply, the modern immigration crisis of the industrial direct result, an unintended result, of the political upheavals and wealth inequalities those empires produced and sustained to this day. When President Monroe issued his doctrine in 1823, it was hailed by Latin American leaders. At last, they thought, U.S. neutrality toward their fight for independence from Spain would end. Gran Colombia's revolutionary president at the time, Francisco de Paula Santander, praised it as, quote, an act worthy of the classic land of liberty. With the English Navy and the United States as nominal protectors of Latin America's independence, the new countries of the region at least managed to avert the catastrophes that befell much of Africa and Asia when the European powers divided those regions between them during the great colonial partitions of the late 19th century. But subsequent U.S. presidents turned the doctrine into a weapon of systematic oppression. Latin America, especially the Caribbean basin, became a U.S. dominion with North American adventurers repeatedly seeking to grab more territory. South America's great liberator, Simón Bolívar, grew so weary of the constant arrogance from our leaders in Washington that he declared before his death the United States seemed, quote, destined by providence to plague America with torments in the name of freedom. As thousands of U.S. businessmen and adventurers headed south of the border, Latin America became the birthplace of the first great multinational U.S. corporations, enriching some of the country's most celebrated families. The factual record of how the entire region was pillaged is so ample, so sordid, that it almost defies comprehension. And I don't mean the simple outright seizure and annexation of Texas and half of Mexico's territory during the Mexican-American War, territory that would later become California, New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, and portions of Colorado and Utah. It was also the exploitation of Central and South America and the Caribbean islands. William Aspinwall, who made millions with his Panama Railroad in 1855, transporting North Americans across the isthmus from the East Coast to the California gold fields. Or Cornelius Vanderbilt's Nicaragua Transit Company. Or the psychotic episode of Soldier of Fortune William Walker, who during his two-year rule as a dictator of Nicaragua in the 1850s, reinstituted slavery, declared English an official language of Nicaragua, and was welcomed at the White House. More than 11,000 North Americans moved to Nicaragua during Walker's reign, with 3,000 to 5,000 joining his occupation army. There was the infamous United Fruit Company, the first great U.S. multinational corporation, with plantations in Cuba, Honduras, Costa Rica, Guatemala, and Colombia, its own railroads and shipping companies, the most powerful force in the region. There was the Havemeyer family, sugar trust that monopolized all sugar supplies to the United States with plantations in Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic, shipping all their produce to refineries in Brooklyn, Boston, and Baltimore under the name of Domino Sugar. There was the Guggenheim family, with its massive investments in Mexican railways, and the Hearst family, with cattle ranches of more than 1 million acres in northern Mexico. During the late 19th century reign of dictator Porfirio Diaz, Mexico was basically sold off to foreign investors. By 1910, more than 40,000 North Americans had settled in Mexico. 15,000 of them had gobbled up land, and they controlled 130 million acres, 27% of the entire surface area of Mexico was owned by U.S. citizens. Americans owned 78% of Mexico's mines, 73% of its smelters, 58% of its oil, 68% of its rubber business. 1898, of course, was the climactic year for the creation of the U.S. colonial empire, as has been stated, with the seizure of Puerto Rico, Cuba, the Philippines, and Guam during the Spanish-American War. But the list of direct military interventions that ensued during the 20th century is mind-boggling. The sponsoring by Teddy Roosevelt and the U.S. Navy of a whole country, Panama, just so Americans could secure land to build the Panama Canal. Interventions in Nicaragua 5 different times, including the war against Sandino liberation fighters from 1926 to 1933 and the CIA funding of the Contras in the 1980s. Mexico invaded 3 times, Honduras 2x, Cuba 3x after 1898, not counting the CIA-sponsored Bay of Pigs fiasco in 1961. Guatemala and the Arbenz coup in 54, Chile and Allende coup in 1973. The Dominican Republic invaded 3 times, including President Johnson's sending of thousands of U.S. troops in 1965 to squash a people's revolt for democracy. Haiti in 1915 and again in 1994. Panama again in 1918, 1925, 1989. If Latin America had not been pillaged by U.S. capital since its independence, millions of desperate workers would not now be coming here in such numbers to reclaim a share of that wealth. And if the United States is today the world's richest nation, it is in part because of the sweat and blood of copper workers of Chile, the tin miners of Bolivia, the fruit pickers of Guatemala and Honduras, the cane cutters of Cuba, the oil workers of Venezuela and Mexico, the pharmaceutical workers of Puerto Rico, the ranch hands of Costa Rica and Argentina, the West Indians who died building the Panama Canal, and the Panamanians who maintained it. But all that exploitation sparked a result the empire never expected. By World War II, with migration from Europe closed off, the U.S. initiated the Bracero program, recruiting and contracting as many as 350,000 Mexican workers a year and tens of thousands of Puerto Ricans to work in U.S. factories and fields. The result of all that labor contracting and all the instability our foreign policy created has resulted in multiple Latino migration waves to the U.S., differing not only in their ethnic and racial characteristics, but in their classic origins. Throughout all of this, the Monroe Doctrine has been the excuse for U.S. meddling. It has never been renounced by the U.S. Even the Pope and the Vatican finally rejected this year the doctrine of discovery, the white supremacist theory that justified European domination of the native peoples of America. But our government still clings to Monroe's words, America under Washington control. Thankfully, most Latin American nations no longer follow dictates from the U.S. Recent elections in Mexico, Honduras, Colombia, Brazil, and Chile have brought progressive governments to virtually the entire region, and China's rise in the world economy has meant new loans and financing for the region's needs without the same strings that always came with loans from the Western banks. There are no wars, no major wars in Latin America today, no nuclear weapons, a growing commitment to tackle wealth inequality. The region has gone from a place of despair to one of hope. You don't hear any mention of this in the U.S. commercial media's reporting on Latin American migrants. Coverage that always seems to focus on the images of chaos and a border overrun. So much of the immigration debate focuses more on heat than light, more on one-sided sloganeering than dispassionate discourse, more on stoking the worst emotions among the American people rather than an honest attempt to understand the roots of the problem, than devise the most humane and sensible solutions. Throughout the administration of four presidents, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, Donald Trump, and now Joe Biden, congressional leaders have failed to agree on how to overhaul the U.S. immigration system. They have repeatedly deadlocked on such an overhaul precisely because the stakes are so high in an increasingly multiracial nation. Any comprehensive immigration reform, after all, will determine who can legitimately become a U.S. citizen in the 21st century. It will reshape the nation's voting population for decades to come and will alter the distribution of political and economic power at both the national and local level, and they know it. That's why they resist immigration reform. The sudden surge of people fleeing one country for another did not arise from thin air or from individual decisions made to simply seek a better life in another country. Rather, they are manifestations of profound flaws in the economic and political systems of our modern world. Much of it, I would submit to you, is the unintended harvest of past colonial empires and of a new stage of economic and political domination where the U.S., an empire in decline, is determined to use its military might to master the world. A rules-based order where Washington makes all the rules. The enormous contributions of the Latin American diaspora to U.S. prosperity rarely gets acknowledged. It is critically important to extol those contributions when others try to disseminate stereotypes of Mexico and other Latin American nations sending only criminals and paupers. Even today, the hardest, most menial, and least appreciated work in the U.S. is performed by Latino migrants. After 60 years of steady migration, the children of those Latin American migrants, most of them born or raised in this country, are on the cusp of transforming the United States. It is up to us, but especially the young people of this country, to demand a new way, an end to the empire whose evil deeds the Monroe Doctrine first sought to cloak in elegant words. There has been progress. Latin America is no longer the backyard of the empire. It is the front yard of a world movement for social justice and peace. From Mexico to Honduras, from Cuba to Venezuela and Nicaragua, from Colombia to Brazil and Chile, from Bolivia to Argentina, the governments and peoples of Latin America are charting their own future. But Latin America no longer fears the CIA, the IMF, and their own right-wing elites, determined to live in a multipolar world, to sell their goods and build alliances with whoever treats them with respect, whether it is be a European power or Russia or China or the U.S. They're tired of Washington demanding obedience to its version of democracy and reacting only with sanctions, arrogance, and regime change to all who dare challenge its hegemony. We are here today to say those days are over. It's time the American people learned the truth about the U.S. role in Latin America. Time that Congress, the White House, and all Americans of goodwill demand an end once and for all to the heinous Monroe Doctrine and the ideology behind it.
Okay, so there was Juan Gonzalez, Harvey. I wonder how many history teachers in the United States are teaching that the Monroe Doctrine led to our immigration issue at the border. You can find the rest of the webinar, which shows the connection between the Monroe Doctrine and so much more, including the International Monetary Fund, the Organization of American States. You can find this at codepink.org/buriethemonroedoctrine to get the whole webinar, which was extraordinary. So, Harvey, we got one more topic to talk about or one more topic to share. And it's just a short jump how we have taken our thought process with regard to the Monroe Doctrine and extended it to the whole world.
Yeah.
Found this webinar at Democratize Europe, or DIEM25, Democracy in Europe Movement 2025. And the topic was, is Europe filled with countries that are vassals of the United States? And you particularly liked the discussion by Yanis Varoufakis.
Yeah, so, former Greek prime minister, who I thought he really lays it all out. exactly what's happening there. And it bears on the Ukraine war for sure.
Oh, it sure does.
Yeah, let's hear that.
And I remember the aspiration was for us to join the European Union, to join Europe. But the aspiration had an ideology behind it. And you had the ideology of the third pole, not the third world, but the third pole. The idea was, and that was a very strong idea, in particular in France, that there was a very dangerous conflict, Cold War conflict, brewing between the United States that, for in European eyes, was too extreme in its embrace of markets, of capitalism, of cutthroat competition, of not caring about society because it's all, it was all about the market. And the Soviet Union, which was, you know, the pendulum having reached the exactly opposite, not enough market, not enough freedom, not enough this, not enough that, authoritarianism, a kind of orientalism as well, you know, the Eastern Slavs. And Europe was being presented as a work in progress. And what was the point of that work in progress? The point was to create a United States of Europe that would be a third pole between the competing extremities of the United States and of the Soviet Union. That was the European Union that I grew up with as an ideological concept, to which both center-left and the center-right subscribed. The last time that that concept and that that narrative remained somewhat relevant to the reality of Europe was when George W. Bush invaded Iraq. And the Franco-German axis, which has been the skeleton, the foundation, the backbone of the European Common Market first, and then the European Union, valiantly, and to their great credit, the great credit of Jacques Chirac in France, and of Schroeder at the time, they said, no, we are not going to invade. We are rejecting this. We are not going to be vassals of the United States. We think that Saddam Hussein is a criminal, but that doesn't mean that we will condone an invasion. So the Brits with the, you know, with the Australians, the Anglosphere invaded, and the European Union maintained a position of strategic autonomy. I use these words poignantly because strategic autonomy is meant to be, even today as we speak, the official target of Brussels, of Berlin, and of Paris. Except that it is no longer possible and it is no longer relevant in the way that it was when George W. Bush was invading Iraq. Now, what happened since then? A number of things, but you will allow me to say, revealing the fact that I'm an economist, you know, that I have this flaw in my character, that it was the great crisis of 2007-2008. The construction of the euro, which was completed in 2000-2001, and then the collapse of Wall Street, which became an existential crisis for the Eurozone. How does this connect at all to what's happening in Ukraine, to what's happening with the, in the US-China relationship, which has escalated to a state of Cold War, Taiwan, and so on? Well, let me give you two or three examples of how it relates. Firstly, we've all known that the greatest weapon of the United States, and we can see this today as we speak, is not so much its nuclear arsenal, it's not the Marines, it's not its Air Force, it's not its Navy, it's the US dollar. Something that General de Gaulle knew very well, and his finance minister, a certain Mr. Giscard d'Estaing, who was later one of the successors of de Gaulle, at the time was the finance minister. He referred to the American dollar as the currency enjoying an exorbitant privilege. Now, we've had the euro. The euro was again promised in the same way that when I was young, the European Union was promised to be the third pole, a superpower that will create a kind of balance between the United States and the Soviet Union. That was a lie. Didn't turn out that way. Similarly, the euro was promised as a potential challenger of the US dollar. Now, it is definitely a very strong currency. It's a very large currency. Some countries use it as a secondary reserve currency, but it has never challenged the US dollar. Let me make this a bit more concrete. There are those within the establishment of the European Union who aspire, we fantasize of, a European army. There are two problems with the European army, like every army. The first problem is, who's going to pay for it? The Americans, some simply mint dollars. They just print dollars and pay for the American military industrial complex. Now, we don't have a mechanism for doing this in Europe. The European Central Bank is not allowed to mint money to channel into an army. Maybe that's a good thing, but I'm simply pointing it out. The second problem that you have when you are creating an army is you have to answer the question, who is going to send the men and women who are armed and members of the military to war? Who's going to make the decision to say, okay, we start the war, let's go. Go and kill people now. In the United States, it's the American president. In the United Kingdom, it's the British prime minister. And of course, they have to have some kind of legitimation from Congress in the United States and from the House of Commons in Britain. In Europe, who's going to send people to war? There's simply absolutely no political legitimacy or power for any act of war as Europe. So you can have, as you know, the European economy can be as large as it can be. It can be the largest economy in the world for all that matters. Okay, but it cannot finance an army, and it cannot make political decisions that involve either war or peace. I've already said that in previous meetings. If there is a peace process, I hope there is one tomorrow morning, or actually yesterday, about Ukraine, nobody's there to represent us. And so now I'm coming to Emmanuel Macron. Emmanuel Macron goes to China in the middle of the escalating Cold War between the United States and China. What's the point of him going to China unless he plays the role of the third pole or representing the Europe of the third pole that was promised people like me back in the early 1970s, mid-1970s, when the European Union was still presenting itself as a balancing mechanism between the United States and its adversary back then, the Soviet Union, today China. So it made sense for Macron to go. Macron challenges the idea that Russia must be defeated and Moscow must be taken. That will be the only end, just end to the war in Ukraine. He doesn't believe that. He's not allowed to say anymore that he doesn't believe it. But it's true. We know that he doesn't believe it. So he goes to China and says the right thing. Let's be clear. You know, we progressives, we loathe Macron's domestic policies in France, but there is a long tradition in France of presidents of France saying the right thing internationally. I will never forget the courage of Jacques Chirac, somebody who was far more right-wing than Macron, both when it came to the war in Iraq, I mentioned that before, but also he is the only Western leader to have gone to the Palestinian occupied territories and actually scolded, pointing fingers at the occupying forces of the Israelis, telling them in their face that they are criminals in the way they are treating the Palestinians. So there is a tradition there. So he goes there to China, and he says something which is far more important, that we do not want to be vassals of the United States, which is astonishing that, you know, is there any European who claims we should be vassals of the United States? And yet he says that, and he's being lambasted across Europe. Just goes to show the state of affairs of the European Union. But he says something else which was very important. And it shouldn't be controversial, but it is controversial. And that is a sign of the terrible state of our political debates here in Europe. He said, and I quote from The Guardian, "France is for the status quo in Taiwan and a peaceful resolution to the situation." Now, that shouldn't be at all controversial. Because what is the status quo of Taiwan? Taiwan is not Ukraine. Let's be clear about that. Taiwan is part of China. Historically, there's just a split, an ideological split, two different administrations. Yeah, it's the same language, the same ethnicity, it's the same everything. That is the position of the United Nations. So you have the president of France going to Beijing and effectively confirming that the position of the United Nations should be the position of France and Europe. And he's immediately taken to the cleaners for not supporting what? The independence of Taiwan. But the Americans themselves have not recognized Taiwan as independent. But they demand, listen to this, I'll say this once more. The United States government is not recognizing the independence of Taiwan. But the moment the president of France says that there is no issue about, no question about recognizing the independence of Taiwan, suddenly he's taken to the cleaners. Because the United States, Washington, expects of European leaders these days to behave in ways that are functional to the policies of the United States without even having the right to adopt the official position of the United States if the official position of the United States is not in sync with that of the CIA, the Pentagon, the military industrial complex. So it's not that the European Union is a vassal of the United States. It's worse than a vassal, because the vassals under feudalism, lest we forget, had a degree of autonomy. Remember what the vassals were. The vassals were proto-capitalists, yeah, who would lease land from the feudal lord. The feudal lord had massive authority over them, but they would lease land and do little capitalist things with it, you know, get the peasants to produce for them. They would collect the harvest. They would pay a rent, ground rent, to the feudal lord. They would have a degree of autonomy. That's what the vassals were. Europe doesn't have that anymore. It is the euro crisis, the debt crisis, the banking crisis, the fact that the Federal Reserve, the Central Bank of the United States, had to save the German and the French banks back in 2009, 2010, 2011. The fact that the Europeans have not managed to take advantage of the euro crisis, of the pandemic, and so on, in order to create something resembling a fiscal union, a political union, a democratic union. These are all the reasons why we are worse than merely vassals, worse than mere vassals. The war in Ukraine in particular, who doesn't remember Mrs. Nuland, the, what was she, and the Undersecretary of State, who was caught on tape. She was recorded at some point in 2014, when the United States was plotting, essentially, a regime change in Ukraine. When she was told, but what will the European Union say? What will the Europeans say to her? And she responded, fuck the Europeans. And that's exactly what they did. Putin played a major role in that, because that criminal idiot invaded. He took the bait and invaded. And I call him a criminal idiot because I deeply in my soul believe that he's both criminal and an idiot. The worst combination a person can be. That's Putin. So he bites the bait. And the United States government and the ruling class is having a field day. In one go, they blow up Nord Stream 1. They secure a complete and utter monopoly over the gas market of Europe, taking it away from the complete and utter monopoly of Gazprom. And suddenly, you know, countries like Finland, like Sweden, that withstood decades of the Cold War, refusing to take sides and remaining neutral, suddenly they fell headlong into the NATO trap. So, no, Europe is not a vassal of the United States. We are in a far worse situation than that. We're completely bonded to them. We are serfs. We're not even vassals. We are not even serfs. Serfs had certain rights under feudalism. The European Union regime establishment has utterly subjugated Europe to the United States. And the reason for this is not failure. The reason for this is not, you know, stupid people running Brussels and Frankfurt and Paris and Berlin and Rome. No, it's money. Because if you are a German industrialist, a French wine, mass wine exporter or champagne exporter, right? If you are an Italian fashion group, your main export market is the United States. And the United States prints dollars to give you so that you can take those dollars and take it to Wall Street to buy stuff as well as real estate in Florida and California, here, there, and everywhere. And you do not want the euro to become a competitor to the dollar, because your profits depend on the continuation of the American exorbitant privilege. And in order to continue the American exorbitant privilege, the American dollar's exorbitant privilege, which is functional and instrumental to European capitalists who are exporting to the United States to continue to remain super wealthy with their share portfolio proliferating and burgeoning in Wall Street, in the city of London, outside the European Union, you do really enjoy the idea as a European mega capitalist oligarch of Europe being a vessel of the United States of America. So if Europe is a vessel of the United States of America, it's because the European oligarchy wants Europe to be a vassal of the United States of America, and even worse. Thanks.
There was Yanis Varoufakis, and so he's considering the countries of Europe as worse than vassals.
Yes, he explains that under feudalism, vassals had actually had some rights. They could actually make some choices, whereas Europe is stuck. You know, they can't do anything that doesn't match, not even stated U.S. policy, but Biden administration and CIA policy.
And the parallels between this and what Juan Gonzalez just talked about with regard to Latin America and the United States, I mean, it's really shocking. But the most shocking thing is, to me, is we've taken these great powers of Europe and they kowtow to us.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. What are they thinking?
Well, I think from the way he describes it toward the end, all of the money.
I guess.
All of these countries see the U.S. as their primary export market.
Yeah.
It, you know, the U.S. has already shown it'll sanction anybody if they don't do what they want them to do. Maybe they're afraid the U.S. would sanction them if they opposed any of what they want to do, especially with regard to Ukraine and, you know, expanding NATO all around the whole world. Practically, you know, talking about how Finland and Sweden had just abandoned their long
neutrality.
Neutrality.
Good gracious. When we look at things holistically, globally, it doesn't make any sense. I'm glad he brought up Charles de Gaulle, because I was just thinking the way Europe is now, Charles de Gaulle and Winston Churchill should be rolling over in their graves and should be coming out of their graves to try and shake some folks. I really was hoping that the powers in Europe would say NATO has got to stop. We don't like the policies of NATO, and we're going to pull out.
Macron goes to China and
yeah,
we can't decouple, you know, they're too important and we need to have our own national interests in sight. And as far as Taiwan, it's well established, you know, and, you know, the world overall, that Taiwan is part of China. There's a one China. And he comes back to Europe and beat over the head for saying that. And it's the official U.S. position.
It's right. It's the, you know, he's vilified when it's the position of the U.N. It's the position of the U.S.
Yeah.
The lack of organization within this world today is shocking. You know, we've discussed four different things and you'd think they were different. But when you look at how they're connected,
all of those are just different manifestations of the neoliberal doctrine in the U.S., which is we can do anything we want, anywhere we want. We're exceptional.
And I was glad Yanis brought up about the American currency again.
Right. Yes.
I mean, we got this credit card. So like KJ did the other week. Like
KJ did the same thing.
Yeah. So we better leave it there, because there is so much there. Now, did you notice that Yanis is referring to the U.S. as blowing up the Nord Stream pipeline as if it's common knowledge? There's no controversy in Europe. The U.S. did it. So, well, we hope that this show gives you some information to work with and especially gives you more resources in which to get information that goes against the mainstream, but is also information without a corporate agenda. You had Breaking Points, which you can find on YouTube, Caitlin Johnstone, which you can find on SoundCloud, Juan Gonzalez, and the Barry the Monroe Doctrine webinar is on Code Pink website. And of course, Juan Gonzalez is also a regular co-host on Democracy Now! And a new one for me is Democracy in Europe Movement. And it's DIEM25.org. DIEM25.org. And that stands for Democracy in Europe Movement. And that's where you can find Yanis Varoufakis and lots of others. So to finish up, Harvey recommended a song by David Olney called See How the Mighty Have Fallen. And so here it is.
Oh, people, see how the mighty have fallen. Well, a man must hold the power, or the power will hold a man. What goes up comes down, yeah, it all comes round, ever since this world began. Well, once Saul was a mighty king, he was a ruler over all. But his pride had swelled him, and his jealousy killed him. And that's how he fell so low. I'm talking about old people. See how the mighty have fallen. Old people falling down the ground. Wow, wow. Well, Saul went into battle. Yes, yeah, Saul went into war. Before the day was through, 1,000 he slew. But David killed 10,000 more. Well, Saul's poor mind was poisoned, and he called for David's head. Well, he chased him through the mountains, but he never could catch him. And he lost his life instead. And I'm talking about old people. See how the mighty have fallen. Old people falling down to the ground, yeah. Now all you daughters of Israel, weep for your fallen king. For he clothed you in gold and silk and apparel, and he made your heart to sing. And shouted from the mountain and across the valley plain. Well, he roared like a lion and he soared like an eagle. But it fell like a drop of rain. And I'm talking about old people. See how the mighty have fallen.